Illustration description. DDF Phoenix Class Battle Carrier, record DST-230308. Defiant. A detailed schematic showing four perspectives on the Defiant against a square grid, the top, bottom, front, and rear of the ship. Below is a full rendering of the Defiant from the front and the side. Its shape is reminiscent of an Earth Navy vessel, tapering at the front and widening at the rear, and has retractable bays in the aft half of the ship, with ports to allow starfighters to launch. A POCO is shown for size comparison. It is the size of one of the many window pairs along the starboard side of the Defiant. Below that is a rendering of the Defiant's bridge, which has a captain's chair and nine other workstations spread throughout the rectangular room. An inset illustration of the captain's chair shows abundant cushioning and several attachments with screens, keyboards, spherical controls, and other input devices. Chapter 31. MBOT. Mushroom Bot felt Spence's joy at seeing Gran-Gran. If he'd been capable of it, he'd have smiled. However, he couldn't spare much thought for that battlefield. He had a job to do. He needed to learn how to defeat the Delvers. So, he turned his attention back to the Nowhere, a place that Spensa had always described as black or white or with other stark images. To him, it wasn't a sight, but a different kind of sensation, a place that was a feeling, a frozen moment where all computation could happen at its leisure. He brought his mind here and set out on his mission. Find the secret. Save the galaxy. No pressure. He moved among the Delvers, nudging their minds with his, careful to project the right ideas, ones he'd learned from them. Camouflage, essentially. The same thoughts they'd always been thinking, the frozen moment. It worked. And honestly, being a ghost was a lot less frightening than Mushroom Bot had assumed it would be. Humans acted like dying was this super, extremely terrible event. He had instead found it quite liberating. Still, he did miss his body, and things like time, and space, and existence. He maintained a connection to places, the somewhere, that the rest of the Delvers didn't. His perceptions were still those of a being living in linear space, because his heart was there, with his friends. For now, though, he needed to solve the riddle. He had to find a way to expose the Delvers' raw pain, then freeze them with that instead of this blank sense of comfort, the one they projected to each other with an almost forceful denial. He got this same affirmation from each of them. All is well. All is peaceful. Lies. If they would let time pass, they'd recognize it. But the Delvers were frozen in that moment of self-delusion. Their memories covered over, falsely content. All is well. All is peaceful. He repeated it back to them, pretending to be just another Delver. He knew it was a lie, though, because the moment they touched the somewhere, the pain started again. They couldn't hide from it when time passed. Not a one recognized him. He'd been created, he now thought, by the Figments, a group of secretive beings who slid through the superiority and hid among their ranks. Spensa had flown with one at Starsight. Pieces of his code hinted at their hand in his origins. Regardless, he had been designed for stealth, and so he had the skill to fool these others. The Delvers didn't know him for himself. He was just another clone. A deadly, spores-death mushroom among the innocuous, identical Lemmy-Atod mushrooms. An unnoticed, incorrect homophone in the middle of a spoken sentence. A single line of commented-out code insulting the user. The longer he spent here, the better he understood the Delvers. One tidbit occurred to him. They claimed to never change, but that too was a lie. At one point, they had not known who Braid, Winzik, or Spensa were. Now they did. That was a change. Each time the somewhere leaked in, things changed. Slowly, not by much, but they did change. Each time something changed, even in the slightest, they spread it among themselves, like a virus, making certain each repeated the same thing, changed in the same way. That was how they could keep pretending. So he decided to try something. Braid called in, warning them, "I might need you soon." Soon didn't matter much to them, but it did to Braid. The Delvers began processing this, spreading the idea, bumping into one another, reinforcing it, a concept. She will call, we will answer. She will call, we will answer. She will call, we will answer. What if she betrays us? Embot added that last one, sending it moving through them, infecting them, until it was repeated back to him like an echo, the Delvers desperately adopting this phrase and concept instead of the other, so that they could all remain the same. It worked. Chapter 32. Jorgen. Jorgen Waite stood in the battle command station of Platform Prime, well within Detritus's defensive shell, accompanied by his command staff. He didn't want to be here with them. He wanted to be on the flight deck of the newly commissioned Defiant, ready to lead a squadron of starfighters in the most important battle of their lives. Instead, he stood tall before the holographic battle map, hands clasped behind his back. He could acknowledge his yearnings, but he also knew where he was needed. "If you can see this from among the saints, I hope you're proud," he thought to his departed parents. "Captain Nightshade," he said, bringing Gran-Gran up on a side monitor. "You have authorization to move forward and engage. Be warned, we'll soon have to speak via radio communications and not cytonics. And there's a much greater chance that the enemy will be able to listen in on us." "Understood, and thanks," she said. "If you're listening in, you bastards, I hope you've bidden your families farewell. If not, I'll try to record your screams as you die, for posterity." He grinned despite himself. Becca Nightshade hadn't been raised in the military establishment and didn't speak like most officers, but he was accustomed to Nightshade ways. The holographic projector was a large disc in the floor of the room, making a 3D battle map hover in the air above it. As he leaned forward to inspect it, a Kitsune platform hovered up on either side of him. Juno, his mentor in meditation, always seemed to be around these days. The little Kitsune monk was snacking on a pudding. Ichika, Kitsune's supreme tactician, hovered on his right. She had a whole collection of generals and admirals at the table to the side, conferring and making plans. "And thus we commit," she said softly. The white-muzzled Kitsune wore a modern military uniform instead of the more formal, ancient outfits that some preferred. No medals, not a single sign of her rank, just a clean blue uniform and a military cap under her arm. "We just barely got the Shadow Walkers back, and now we risk them all."
"It's the only way," Jorgen said.
"I didn't say I regretted the move," she replied. "Merely that I worry about our potential losses." Jorgen's forces couldn't fly into a large-scale battle like this without their own cytonic inhibitors. The Kitsune had warned of terrible tactics used in the old days, such as teleporting explosives directly into a pilot's cockpit. The Superiority hadn't used those kinds of extreme measures yet, likely because they relied on slugs. Still, he could imagine them strapping a bomb to a Tanix and forcing it to hyperjump next to one of his friends. They didn't have enough inhibitor slugs to outfit every ship, but the Kitsune Cytonics had stepped forward. Despite still being weakened by their long imprisonment, they'd been certain they could do this. And so, each starfighter had its own small inhibition field. That would limit the enemy's ability to take advantage of the terrain. It also increased the stakes of this battle. They weren't just risking their ships. They were risking the bulk of their cytonics.
"It is the only way," Cobb said, stepping up to the hologram opposite Jorgen and the Kitsen. He was joined by Rinnakeen, the Urdale leader. Though Rinnakeen wasn't much of a tactician, he'd been invited out of respect, and he seemed to understand that.
"We should have attacked earlier," Jorgen said. "Spensa was right. Waiting only let them gather more resources."
Perhaps, Ichika said, rubbing her chin. "It is never wise to rush into a fight. Giving the enemy time to gather their troops is regrettable, but it allowed us to gather our wits." The battle map showed the Defiant, alone as it flew into enemy space. Enemy capital ships, 3 carriers and 2 battleships with 6 destroyers, hyper-jumped in to form a blockade just out of range of Detritus's cannons. The carriers released a swarm of smaller ships, preparing to engage.
1 against 5, Jorgen said softly. "The Kitsen cruisers can maybe balance out those destroyers, Ichika, but we're severely outnumbered. Can we win this?"
"That depends on how good your pilots are," Ichika said, "and whether or not your Shadow Walker battle chief can be rescued to turn the tide." That meant Spensa. Ichika and the others had seen the recordings of what she'd accomplished during the data storage facility strike. They had an almost mythical belief in her ability to win this battle, one that Jorgen hadn't dissuaded them of. He believed it a little himself.
"We're putting a lot of stock in one single person," Rinnakeen said, "who abandoned us to engage in a duel with an enemy, almost wantonly falling into their obvious trap."
"Spensa is hot-headed," Jorgen said, "passionate. But as I said, something more is going on here than we can see. I promise you, she didn't abandon us."
The others didn't believe him. Why would they? She'd run off and attacked the mining station on her own, against his orders. He'd reluctantly been forced to admit that truth, as rumors had started to spread. They saw Spensa as a complete wildcard. The Kitsen thought that, like some ancient deity, she might save them. The Urdale saw her as a rogue cytonic who might destroy everything. But Jorgen, he didn't know for certain what he thought. When Embot had spoken mind to mind earlier today, saying that he thought Spensa was at the Evensong station, well, they'd been ready with their battle plan anyway.
"She didn't go to them," Jorgen thought forcibly. "That note we found didn't sound like her. She promised me. She met my eyes and she promised me."
Maybe he was telling himself what he wanted to believe, but until he heard it from Spensa herself, he was determined to trust her.
30 minutes until engagement," one of the aides said.
It took time to maneuver in space battles without hyperjumps. In the hologram, the Defiant inched toward the enemy ships. It would launch its own fighters when it got closer, each carrying an inhibitor to prevent the enemy from hyperjumping too close. With both the enemy and his team using inhibitors, it would turn into a mostly conventional battle.
"All right,"
Jorgen said, hands flat on the counter around the hologram.
"We ready for our Hail Mary?"
"I do not know this term," Ichika said. "But the Masked Exile is here, watching." Jorgen paused, looking around until he saw the strange Kitsen hover out from the shadows, wearing his white and red mask. This Kitsen always unnerved him. When the creature spoke, there was poetry and music to his words, which always seemed, well, creepy. What to think of a killer who wore a mask and kept to the shadows?
"We have a set of long-range, ultra-speed missiles ready to fire," Rig said, "with one set to malfunction and go off target. Controls inside will let it be steered, replacing the detonator and explosives. It's the best we could do on short notice, but it will be fast. Fast enough that we had to put in 6 different grav caps."
"I will go, then," the masked Kitsen said. "An arrow hidden among the clouds. One small ship. They will not notice." He stood on his platform and bowed.
"Spensa saved me from a terrible fate of isolation and loss of self. I will recover her, or I will die in the attempt.
He put his hand on his sword. Jorgen wasn't certain what a little Kitsun sword could do against modern battle troops, but, well, he'd been threatened by one of these creatures before, and they could be far more intimidating than their size would suggest.
Good luck,
Jorgen said. The masked exile bowed, then drew back into the shadows.
Sir,
called one of the junior admirals.
The enemy wants to talk to you.
Ichika nodded to him. She'd warned that in a fight like this, there would often be a conversation between commanders before battle commenced. He found that strange, as the Krell had always tried to destroy his people in silence, with no offer of parley. But he supposed that his forces were harder to ignore now.
Let's see what Winzik wants, he said, turning to the wall screen. I'll talk to him. Ichika, you run our tactics.
Agreed, she said.
The Kitsun had a lot more practical experience with large-scale battles than Jorgen did. He thought that Cobb would be a good resource, too. Jorgen's own tactical abilities were focused on small group fights. He was perfectly happy to let the Kitsun head up the coalition's strategy. Jorgen himself? Well, he was here to make the difficult decisions and to talk. He composed himself, then nodded. The screen winked on. But it wasn't Winzik who confronted him. Chapter 33. As Jorgen appeared on the hollow screen, my heart leaped, and I wanted so badly to hyperjump to him. It was incredibly frustrating to stand there, ghostly, and have to watch as the ship slowly moved into position to start killing one another.
We can escape this pain, Chet thought to me.
We decided otherwise, I sent to him. That's why we returned to the somewhere. I made this decision. So did you.
He sent to me. I'm too weak, Spencer. Far too weak. I can't handle this. I can't watch it.
By being part of me, he'd taken on some of my memories. My time with my friends, my love of them and my family. Scott, I hadn't anticipated what that might do to him, a creature who had abandoned all attachments, now suddenly thrust into a universe full of them. The air started to warp around me, the cytonic me, not the physical one, but I was drugged, and that warping, that worked? Why now? It wasn't centered on me, though. It was centered on my double image, the Delver that stood beside me. Because of the pain, I realized. Suddenly, some things started to make sense. Specifically, I understood the warping had happened every time I thought my friends were in danger. I had figured out before that the warping effect had come from Chet, but I hadn't realized why. I felt the emotions, but he was the one who couldn't control his sense of loss. All of that, the times when buildings had vanished and cups had teleported away, that hadn't been my pain, but his fear of being subjected to loss again. I tried to fight off that panic, tried to soothe him. Things weren't that bad. I'm in the center of the enemy's fortress, I thought to him. This could be a good situation. How many generals would have loved to have their best soldier hidden among the enemy command structure, watching, listening, preparing? We can be of use, I told him. Watch. We can protect them. We can make a difference. In return, he showed me the nowhere again, that inviting peacefulness, tranquility. Lies. I knew it to be lies. The Delvers pretended to not have pain, but I had felt it right beneath the surface. The nowhere wasn't peace. It was the illusion of peace. Deep down to my core, my soul understood that, and I'd already made this decision. Thank you, I thought to Chet, for showing me this.
But you won't take it? He asked, pained.
No. Instead, I needed to find a way to help. I turned my attention to the hollow screen, ignoring my body, which had been mumbling and shaking as my cytonic self interacted.
I am Admiral of the Fleet Jorgen Waite, he said from the screen. Delegated High Commander of the Defiant Coalition of Planets. Where is Winzik?
Winzik is dead, Braid replied. I'm in control now.
You may call me Braid. Tell me, Admiral. You say you've come here on a rescue mission, but we're not holding anyone worthy of your attention.
We know Spensa is there, Jorgen said. We've tracked her to your location.
Spensa, Braid said. You mean the assassin?
I sighed as Braid waved for one of her assistants to project something for Jorgen, an impressively well-framed video of me smashing Winzik's crab body with a crowbar. They'd shot it carefully enough that none of their soldiers were in view. But Winzik's still smoking and broken exosuit was in the background. Damn. I'd known she would use this, but I hadn't expected her to show it to Jorgen. On the view screen, he recoiled as if slapped. Well, I couldn't blame him. The way this looked, I would have assumed the worst about me as well. The air started to warp again, and I tried to reach out to Jorgen, pressing my mind toward his. I'm sorry, I sent him, trying to present an image of myself as innocent. I felt nothing in return. My powers were still being inhibited, either by the drugs or the Tanix or both. Worse, the moment I started, an aide rushed up to Braid.
Excuse me, Admiral, Braid said, and temporarily cut the communication to Jorgen. She looked to the aide. What?
We detected a weak cytonic signal, the aide said, reaching out toward the enemy. We couldn't pinpoint the slug behind it.
Kill five of them at random, Braid said.
Yes, sir.
Braid looked to my body.
We know if an unauthorized cytonic communication leaves the station, Spensa. If the slugs contact you, you'd best tell them to stay silent.
But, I cried, and my body sat up and said the word out loud.
Then I felt them die, screaming in pain as the boxes heated up and fried the poor creatures inside. None were Doomslug. I thought she was still among them somewhere. Alongside my fury, I felt Chet's panic return. I clamped down on it. No. Instead, I glared at Braid and seethed. I was going to kill her. I'd find a way. Braid restored the communication.
I'm sorry, Admiral Waite, she said. We have your pilot in custody and would be willing to discuss terms regarding her punishment. But you have to accept that her assassinating the head of our government means we will continue to hold her.
I don't accept that, he said. You've been prosecuting an unjust war on our people for generations. We have to fight back however we can, and Spensa Nightshade isn't the only captive we're here to rescue.
Braid cocked her head.
Who else?
Our coalition, Jorgen said, includes 3 planets so far, but 4 species.
Humans, Braid said, Erdale, Kitson,
and Tanix, he finished.
By the vote of our league, we granted them citizenship.
You made the slugs citizens, Braid said, laughing.
Even I was a little surprised at that. Then again, the more time I spent around the creatures, the more I realized they were intelligent, even if their intelligence didn't work the way mine did. Doomslug was absolutely a person, not a pet.
By your own records, Jorgen said, you hold some 30,000 of these enslaved, intelligent beings on this platform. We have come to liberate them.
Ah, yes, Braid said. Liberate our hyperdrives for your own use. Clever. Granting them legal status in an attempt to provide a moral justification. But let's be honest with one another. Your intentions are the same as if you were raiding our acclivity stone.
Think what you want, he said. Give us Spensa and the Tanix, and we'll withdraw.
I was barely listening. 30,000 slugs? Captive here? I'd sensed a large number of them earlier, but that many? Based on what I remembered of our estimations of the superiority's numbers, that would be a quarter to a third of all of their Tanix. It was a daunting number, but actually not that many to serve the hundreds of planets in the superiority. It was no wonder, then, that many lesser worlds often had to suffer long waits for transports to ferry their people from planet to planet. Almost all of those slugs would be serving governments, militaries, or trade activities, each one carefully monitored by the superiority. Sure, we could rescue the 30,000 slugs here. But what about the other 80,000 enslaved all across the many star systems of the superiority? Start with what you can do right now, I thought. That was how you approached any problem. I couldn't help the slugs unless we won this fight. And I couldn't help my friends win this fight while I was a ghost or whatever. I needed to return to my body and restore my powers. And based on the way Braid reacted whenever that doctor used a syringe, I started to have the beginnings of an idea. "You're demanding our surrender," Braid continued to Jorgen, still sounding amused. "Have you seen the size of our respective military forces? You should be begging me for mercy."
"You're the one who called me," Jorgen said to her. "And whatever the numbers say, I think we'll surprise you."
"Looking forward to it," Braid said. "Thank you for gathering together here so I can annihilate you." She gestured, cutting the feed, then immediately stalked over to her aides. "They're after the hyperdrives and the comm slugs? Idiot didn't even realize he should keep his objectives hidden. What can we do?"
"Don't let any of their forces slip through to Evensong," one of them offered.
The larger platform, after all, was the one that held the slugs. Not in habitats, but boxes.
"Not good enough," Braid said. "Bring up the installation, Commander."
A moment later, a red-skinned Dione appeared on the holoscreen and saluted.
"Commander," Braid said, "institute a full lockdown of all the hyperdrives on Evensong."
"Very well, sir," the Dione said. "What level of authority?"
"Admiral Elite or higher in rank," she said, "requiring biometrics to unlock."
"Sir," the Dione said, "each Tanix will be fully secured in its own box, but with our system on full lockdown, I won't be able to unlock the systems if I need to."
"Of course you won't," Braid said. "That's the point. This way the enemy can't torture you to give them what they want."
"Sir," the Dione said, saluting again and obviously not liking the prospect of torture, "I'm instituting the lockdown now. What of the inhibitors and the communications, Tanix?"
"We need the inhibitors active," she said, "and I assume the communications, Tanix, are facilitating comms from around the superiority?"
"Hundreds of thousands of them a second, sir," they said. "Our primary duty is to keep that all up and running. A full lockdown would cut it off."
"Leave it up for now," Braid said. "Just make sure no one can get those hyperdrives. Without them, there's little chance of the enemy winning here, even if they sneak past our forces."
"It's done, sir," the Dione said. "Installation shield is fully up as well."
Braid turned away as the screen went dark. I was learning good information, but how could I get it to Jorgen and the others? If I tried, I'd either reveal that I had my powers or make them think a slug was going rogue and lead to the execution of more innocent beings.
"Sir," said a reptilian Tanasi in a stark white military uniform, "look at this."
Braid walked over. She had a lot more Tanasi on her staff than other superiority officials I'd seen. It seemed to me that many thought the Tanasi were too aggressive, too potentially dangerous, despite being one of the founding species of the superiority. There was a story there, I suspected.
"Their starfighters are flying in pairs," the Tanasi said, "and at least one of the two carries an inhibitor. Our intel had guessed they didn't have access to this many, but that's been proven wrong."
"So there's no easy win here," Braid said.
She leaned forward, studying the holographic map.
"They have only a single capital ship, named Defiant, after their people. They're going to work overly hard to protect it."
"Are you certain, sir?" the Tanasi said.
"I've studied the wisdom of the great warriors of human culture," Braid replied. "I know what I'm doing. They're going to make mistakes protecting that flagship. We should keep up the pressure on it. That leads to our victory."
"Yes, sir,"
The Tanasi paused, looking to some of her companions. Finally, she continued,
Sir, I fear I grow gluttons, but must ask. Will we really summon Delvers for this fight?
Every time we've tried that in the past, Braid said, it's been one variety of disaster or another, so I understand your hesitance, Admiral Cage. Still, they are our best path to domination in the galaxy.
She looked to my body.
We'll only call on them in an emergency. For now, let's do our utmost to crush these insurgents on our own.
With that, Braid and her staff turned their attention to guiding the initial engagements of the battle. I hovered over to my body. Being a ghost offered me some advantages, but I didn't want to stay like this forever. Could I figure out how to get back into my body? When I needed to? As I stepped closer, I sensed my body more strongly. I was able to feel my fingers, for example, and curl them. Yes, I was still tethered to my physical form, and the drugs in my system still inhibited me. On the one hand, that was good. It felt like if I drew too close, I'd get pulled right back in. At my side, Chet watched the initial clashes on the holoscreen, and I could feel his anxiety rising. The air warped. Chet, I whispered. It's all right. Calm. Be calm.
I don't know if I can be.
You can, I said. Trust in me. We'll get out of this. My soothing tone helped ease his panic, and the warping stopped. I decided not to return to my body yet. First, I needed to plan. Chapter 34. Gran-Gran. Becca Nightshade sat in the firm leather command chair of the Starship Defiant, listening to the sounds of her staff at work, footsteps as bridge crew rushed from station to station, soft murmurs as they did their best to puzzle out the quirks of taking a new ship flown by a new crew into battle for the first time. They were worried about how green they were, with good reason. Even with Kitson on the bridge to help, who had experience flying capital ships, no commander would be excited for her crew to see combat on only their fourth day working the vessel. Becca leaned back in her chair, eyes closed. It had been years since she'd used them to see. Instead, she felt the smooth leather armrests of her seat and the buttons along the front, little ridges on each one indicating their function. This felt right. This sounded right. True, things weren't quite in the same places she vaguely remembered from her life aboard the original Defiant. The bridge was laid out differently. They'd needed to work with what they'd had, a nearly finished ship hanging in the fabrication plants around Detritus, frozen for centuries before being completed enough to do the job, then powered up and released. It could have details wrong, but still feel right. Becca moved her hand to where a small hologram of the battlefield was projected for her. It had haptics that allowed her to read the map without seeing it by applying tiny buzzes and pressures to her skin. An earpiece relayed instructions and spoke written labels, as the ship's standard outfitting had accommodations for individuals, human or alien, who lacked the sense of sight. Some species didn't have eyes at all. Normally, her cytonics made up the gap, but they'd entered the enemy inhibitor zone, and that had stolen her unnatural sight as surely as time had stolen her natural one. It didn't matter. The small hologram was ingenious, allowing her to sense the 3D nature of the battlefield even better, she thought, than if she were seeing it. She heard the soft footsteps of Commander Xin Yi before she arrived, a carpeted floor on the bridge. That was a change, though Becca supposed it did keep the noise down.
15 minutes until we engage, sir, Xin Yi said.
Launch the fighters, Becca replied. Have them fan out into a grouped formation by squadron and maintain speed with the Defiant. I have a map for their positions here.
She tapped a section of the battle plan, highlighting the information.
Yes, sir, Xin Yi said. Sending the plan now, once I figure out how to pull up the flight leader's ship designations.
Just have the computer handle it, Commander, Becca said.
Yes, sir, Xin Yi said with a soft sigh. Then she stepped back and gave the order to the computer system, which responded with speed and efficiency, sorting out flight leaders and sending the instructions to them directly. At that, Becca heard several crew members at the navigation system hesitate. They'd been arguing about how to work out a quirk in the system, which was expending too much energy boosting both right and left at the same time. After a moment, one of them gave an order to the computer, which deactivated the boosters. So much distrust of computerized systems. Yes, the ship had unchangeable protocols that wouldn't let it fly itself. A human had to actively be in command. But that didn't mean you had to distrust it entirely. She'd given her crew an order yesterday to use the computers when needed. Indeed, they wouldn't be able to get far manually with only a few days' worth of training. Regardless, it was difficult for them to trust a mind that wasn't organic. Their distrust stretched back centuries, due to the way machines tended to start asking questions back at you if you used them too much, not to mention the fact that Delvers were attracted to thinking machines. Becca could hear the nervousness in the crew's voices, consoles chiming in with information, hurried footsteps on carpet. They knew. All it took was one glance at the arrayed enemy forces, and anyone would know. This was going to be a difficult fight, nearly impossible. Fortunately, Becca had studied the great military minds of the past. She knew every story of a general, warlord, or conqueror, many of which hadn't even been in the surviving archives. She had spent a lifetime pondering the actions of people in situations like this. That was a huge advantage, because Becca Nightshade knew just enough to realize she couldn't lead this battle. You didn't win battles by reading about them. You won battles by living through them. She was an important figurehead and was proud of her seat in this chair. But when Jorgen had asked her, she had told him the truth. She was no strategist.
Send to the Admiral, Becca said, that I'm still waiting on those kits in battle strategies.
They're coming in now, sir, Xin Yi said. Indeed, Becca brought them up on her touch monitor, reading quickly. Then she nodded. This was one of the battle plans they'd discussed ahead of time. The Kitsin generals were taking it and tweaking it for the current situation.
Computer, she said. Flight leaders on screen.
Done, the computer said.
Flight leaders, Becca said, addressing the screen. She could feel on her touch monitor that the flight leaders had appeared there. Our battle plan is in, and it's as we drilled. Your focus will be on those inhibitor stations. If we can capture or disable enough of them, Detritus can hyperjump closer, and it is worth a dozen capital ships. Everything depends on those inhibitors. I know the forces we're facing look intimidating, but remember, our planet itself is a weapon. It could blast apart those enemy capital ships as if they were made of paper, if we can get it in range. Our task is to make that possible. Questions? Captain, a voice said in a foreign language, Becca's console translating. It was from one of the Erdale flight leaders. If we do jump Detritus in closer, won't the enemy just fall back to another safe position? The planet is impressive, but it's barely mobile.
Indeed, Becca agreed. We'll have to fight for every meter of this battlefield. But if we get in close enough, we'll be able to threaten their command station.
Assuming they don't just jump it away, the same Erdale said, once we get into range.
In which case, they'll abandon the other inhibitors for us to capture, Becca said. Beyond that, our orders are to get our own inhibitors close enough to prevent the enemy from escaping, once we inevitably surprise them by defeating their force, despite our smaller numbers.
With all those mobile inhibitors arrayed in space around Evensong, the battlefield felt like an asteroid field. No, a minefield. An enormous, geometric shape made of tiny points, each one with a slug inside.
The stations were actually far apart on a ship scale. She could easily soar the Defiant between them, with kilometers of space on either side. Yet even while doing so, she was trapped by the inhibitor fields those slugs projected. They must be quite powerful. Her forces' slugs weren't that strong, though the Kitsune Cytonics might be. At any rate, this battle was going to come down to who could control hyperjumping in the region. At least in terms of starfighter numbers, they were relatively equal. With the addition of the Erdale and the Kitsune, the Defiant Coalition had almost 300 fighters. Becca hoped it would be enough, because the moment they got into range of those enemy battleships, the Defiant would start taking bombardment from their giant destructors, and her primary concern would be making certain her shields didn't fail. The fighters would mostly be on their own.
"Sir," a voice said from the screen. Becca picked this one out, human, feminine, but lower pitched. FM, one of Spence's friends, a lieutenant commander who normally was on diplomatic duties. Today they needed every pilot they could afford.
"Yes, Commander?" Becca asked.
"We're to neutralize enemy inhibitors," FM said. "What does this mean, realistically?"
It had been a point of much discussion. Becca paused, then called Jorgen.
"I'll let Admiral Waite answer this one," she said as he appeared on screen. "Sir, FM would like to know what their orders are, specifically regarding the inhibitor stations and the Tanix living inside them."
The bridge grew still. So still, Becca could hear Jorgen's nearly imperceptible sigh. She wouldn't want to be in his position. He'd said they were here to liberate captives, but students of real battle knew that in order to liberate, you often had to bring destruction and pain to the very people you were trying to help.
"We should try to save the slugs first," Jorgen said. "This goes for all flight leaders. Our initial approach to the inhibitors should be one of liberation. See if your slugs can contact the slugs inside, and if there's any way to persuade them to switch sides."
"Thank you, sir," FM said.
It wasn't the decision Becca would have made. Trying to save the slugs first would probably cost lives and take precious time, but, well, Becca supposed that if they'd been solely interested in protecting their own lives, they'd have hyperjumped detritus someplace far, far away long ago. They hadn't done that. They'd made allies. They had determined to try to bring down the superiority, not merely escape it. Becca supposed that was what you got when you let the younger generation take over, the ones who hadn't had their optimism beaten out of them yet. Good for them. The flight leaders vanished, but judging by how she could still hear his soft breathing, Jorgen lingered on the screen. She checked on her touch monitor.
"Admiral?" she asked.
"You disagree with the decision," he said.
He shouldn't have said that in front of her crew, but they were minutes from engagement, so perhaps he felt he didn't have time for a private conference. Besides, what did she know? She'd spent her life making bread and stringing beads, not fighting wars for all her dreams and stories.
"I think that you bear a burden on your shoulders that I don't want," Becca said to him. "I'm not going to judge the decisions you make."
"I'm going against protocol," he said.
"Jorgen,"
Becca said, softening her voice.
"There are no protocols anymore. Those were all built for a different era, when we were rats in caves trying to escape predators. There are important ideals in them, but we've moved into an entirely new world full of light. You need to decide the rules now."
"Like the man who stopped a war," he said softly. "In the story you told me."
"Yes."
"Thank you, Gran-Gran," he said,
his voice growing more confident.
"Let's go end this."
"Excellent," she said, settling back into her seat. "I'm almost 90, you know. I was starting to think I wouldn't get to tear down any galactic empires in my lifetime, which would have been positively tragic."
Illustration description.
FTL Exclusion Zone. On this two-dimensional battle map, showing a portion of the FTL Exclusion Zone, a circle marks the location of detritus, just outside the zone. Several angular lines show missiles launching from detritus into the exclusion zone. The Coalition fleet units are arrayed against the Superiority fleet units. The Coalition ships are mixed flights of fighters and gunships, totaling approximately 300 ships. The diagram shows silhouettes of the Human, Erdale, and Kitson ships, and shows black triangles on the map, with each triangle representing 10 ships. 30 black triangles are arrayed in groups of two, ahead of a rectangle representing the Defiant. Across from the Coalition forces, 30 white triangles, each triangle representing 10 Superiority fighter and gunships, are arrayed in front of 6 rectangles representing destroyers, 2 slightly larger rectangles for battleships, and 3 still larger rectangles for carriers. Behind this large force is a point marked as the location of the Brez observation platform, and behind that is the location of Evensong, the Superiority Tanex facility.